Good morning. The Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. It is It's May 10th, 2023. We do have a quorum present. This is a hybrid meeting, so we have Senator Carlson, I believe, is joining us online. We have two items on the agenda today. We're going to give about a half an hour to each this morning. The anticipation is that both bills will be voted on for moving out of the committee today. I'm going to take up House File 402 first. A little procedural background. We did hear the Senate file in this matter before, focused on a couple of particular provisions, although most of the bill is, if only peripherally, is within the jurisdiction of this committee. We laid the Senate file on the table with the expectation that the changes we made to some provisions would be picked up in the HHS bill where the overall package was being assembled. Since that time, we did receive House File 402 from the House. They passed it, sent it to the Senate, got referred down to this committee. So we are going to take up House File 402. We're going to ask the chief author to review what is expected to be a delete everything amendment, the A1 amendment. Copies are available out in the hallway there for members of the public to review. There are also some particular changes to the provisions that this committee addressed last time the bill was in front of us, which we'll have counsel walk through those specific changes as well. Because this is not an author's amendment, we're going to be taking a substantive vote on the amendment itself. After we have discussion and deliberation, then we'll vote on the amendment. Fair enough? Mm-hmm. All right, let's get started. Senator Wicklund, your Thank bill. You. Welcome back to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, this is the bill language is something that we had a little bit of discussion about. If it was a few weeks ago. This is a bill that provides notice and disclosure requirements for certain healthcare entities that are engaging in specific types of transactions. The bill is also gives authorizes the Attorney General to bring an action in district court to enjoin and unwind such transactions in circumstances that are adverse to the public interest. There has been a one of the changes that we've made to the bill. It does clarify that in making a determination regarding a transaction's effect on the public interest, the Attorney General and a court must make a rebuttable presumption that it is contrary to the public interest for a transaction to result in academic healthcare facilities licensed as MHealth Fairview University to, number one, stop being dedicated to the university's public healthcare mission, or secondly, to become owned or controlled directly or indirectly by a for-profit entity or an out-of-state entity. There is language to prohibit healthcare entities from entering into a transaction that will substantially lessen competition or tend to create a monopoly or monopsony. It also requires Minnesota nonprofit HMOs and health systems organized as charitable organizations to return an amount equal to the value of any charitable assets the entity received from the state if the entity transfers control to an out-of-state nonprofit entity or to any for-profit entity. The language extends the state's moratorium on for-profit health maintenance organizations and requires the Commissioner of Health to study and report on the regulation of conversions, mergers, transfers of assets, and other transactions affecting Minnesota health maintenance organizations. And that part of the bill is, or that part of the language is something we've added or we're adding through the delete everything. I don't know, Mr. Chair, if you'd like me to go through the summary by sections or if that's an adequate overview. The bill, when it came before this committee, it was in a similar form in terms of providing oversight of healthcare entity transactions. But we have made changes in terms of specific types of transactions that are not going to be included. We've made additions that have to do with, different factors, some additional factors that the Attorney General must consider. And we added, I'm just looking in my notes to see if there are other substantial changes that we added. We've been working with the House author in terms of the language as well and taking input from multiple stakeholders to adjust some of the parameters of the bill. And we've made changes in like the thresholds for the transaction amounts and composition of board changes. So if there are specific areas you'd like me to go over in more detail, or if you want counsel to point out more specifically the changes, that would be helpful.
Thank you for the overview, Senator Wicklund. I will ask Senate counsel to point out some of the specifics that this committee should be alert to. Ms. Primo.
Mr. Chair and members, looking at the DE, all the sections are new to the committee except for the healthcare transactions section, which the committee heard when we had the Senate file on the floor, in committee. So I'll point out the specific differences related to healthcare entity transactions, that which begins at section 2 on page 2. The language has several clarifying changes. I won't be pointing those out. I'll point out the substantive changes. The first one is on page 5, lines 5.1 to 5.15 create additional exemptions that this language does not include, does not apply to. Page 7, lines 7.31 to 7.33 authorizes the Attorney General to waive parts of the disclosure requirements. Page 9, lines 9.18 to 9.22 provide additional factors for the court to consider or the Attorney General to consider to inform the public interest standard provided for in the bill. Page 9, lines 9.23 to page 10, line 10.6. This creates a rebuttable presumption specific to University of Minnesota healthcare facilities. And the last substantive change is on page 10, subdivision 7, which begins at line 10.30, which classifies certain data as protected, non-public, or confidential, that's held with the Attorney General or the Commissioner.
Senator Wicklund, I understand that the Attorney General's office has also had an opportunity to review this proposal. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, yes. The Attorney General has been working with us all along on the bill, and I did provide the latest, this delete everything over the weekend or late last week. I don't remember which day, but they've had a chance to review it. They did provide feedback yesterday to me, and there are a few things that adjustments to the language that they would like to see us make, and I worked with counsel, and he's reviewed it and provided some comments, but it wasn't in time for me to make a change to the amendment or bring another amendment to it. There were two comments where the Attorney General indicated that the language we have is not in alignment with their powers or policies. And one of those is a provision where we state that prohibits nonprofit healthcare entity from receiving less than full value for its
Can you point a page and line number to us, Senator Wicklund?
Yes. I don't have that noted on the I believe it would be on page 8, and it would be, I believe, in the lines 16 through 19, that area. It would be page 8, I believe, in the lines 8.16 through 8.19. The AG's office indicated that they aren't able to issue the type of waiver, and they provided language to correct that or to update that to replace it.
Do you have that language, Senator Wicklund, or what is your plan with regard to that?
I have it. The Senate Counsel, Counsel Hadella, has the language recommendation from the AG's office, so I have it from him.
And what was his plan with regard to incorporating those changes?
He provided to me a document with all of the track changes and his recommendations, and that's what I received last night. So that's what I do not have incorporated into an amendment.
What was your plan? Technically they could be adopted in the next committee stop. This bill is going to finance from here, although this sounds like kind of a judiciary-related matter. So I'm a little torn here what the anticipation is. What do you recommend as the chief author for us to proceed to make those changes?
I would recommend and commit to you that I will have him work with PREA to take into consideration those particular changes that we need to make and create an amendment to bring forward in finance would be my recommendation.
Okay, we're going to proceed with your presentation, Senator Wicklund, and take any testimony and discussion while Ms. Primo has a chance to review the email that she just received from Senate Counsel Hadella. All right, so why don't you go ahead with what you were saying with regard to the bill?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the last
part. Why don't you go ahead and proceed?
I don't have other further comments. If there are questions about any of the provisions or questions about the bill.
Okay. So, I will note that there are some letters in your packet from MNA and also from MFU for you to consider providing input to the committee and the public regarding this proposal. I'm also going to note that on line 10.7, there is explicit authorization for the Attorney General to enforce this section under section 8.31 of Minnesota statute. That would be the public benefit provisions. And there's also starting on line 10.13, there's some consultation requirements between the Attorney General and the Commissioner and a provision that the data that is exchanged or information they exchange is considered not public, protected non-public data, so they can have confidential consultation with each other. Let's open it up right now for committee discussion and questions. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just by your past reference to the Lyons 10 point, let's see, where was it? There was a reference on that last provision. You stated that that information on page 10, I think it was, oh, here it is, 10.15. There's a classification of data called confidential, and I'm just wondering if that's the proper definition to use. Usually confidential is used for data that's collected under criminal investigations. I don't know if that's the correct reference. Usually it would be in the case of medical data, perhaps it's more of a private data classification. Maybe counsel could give us a reference.
So Senator Limmer, I'm going to ask you to hold the question for a moment as Ms. Primo is working on the previous question that she was addressed.
All right.
But I suspect that these two provisions in here are there just to cover the territory so the Attorney General and the Commissioner can have consult with each other on whatever they need to, but to make sure that the content of that consultation remains not public. So it might not be specific to any anticipated information, but just making sure that whatever they might cover is covered. But we'll ask Ms. Primo to give a little more feedback on that when she's available. Senator Limmer, did you have any other question while you have the floor?
Mr. Chairman, not at this time. I'm trying to catch up. As you know, I came in a little late due to a traffic delay. So I'm trying to catch up right now. So I'll hold any questions until I develop those questions.
I did everything I could to clear the traffic out for you, Senator Limmer.
I'm sure you did. You did a good job.
Not quite. Senator Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm looking at is on those lines 7.30 to 7.33, and looking that the Attorney General may waive the waiting period and all the disclosure, and even the disclosure and submission to the Commissioner. Why would we put all this in here and then give the AG the authority to waive all those requirements without any guidance as to when it would be appropriate for the waiver? I'm a little bit concerned that we're given some authority to the AG to decide who has to put the disclosures in and the notice in and who doesn't. And I'm just wondering why we would do that for one institution and not another.
Senator Wicklund.
Mr. Chair, I can try and give you the best answer I can. I know the AG's office is also here. I believe there is someone here who could maybe speak more specifically to it.
Is there someone present from the Attorney General's office today on this matter? Okay, thank you.
Oh.
Okay, Wicklund, you're on your own for the moment.
All right, thank you. Mr. Chair, I believe that the waiver, I mean, the ability to waive part of the waiting period or
wait, I think your phone a friend just arrived.
Great. That's good. And I won't have to have her correct what I
all right, if you, say. Counsel, if you would go ahead and introduce yourself and your affiliation.
Mr. Chair and members, Erin Conti, I'm an assistant attorney general. I apologize. I missed our phone a friend interlude. So if someone could tell me what opinion would be helpful.
Senator Howe, would you like to repeat your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And sure. I guess what I'm looking at is the section with 7.30 to 7.33 where the Attorney General has the authority to waive any or all of the notification and any of that. I'm just wondering, why isn't there any guidance there for, you know, we're giving up, it looks like we're relinquishing the requirement to have all this provided to and disclosed, not only to, I believe, us, but also to the attorney, to the commissioner. And we're putting all that with the Attorney General's with no guidance on what we believe the intent of why we would do that. And he'd have total discretion on the way I read this, on he could enforce this on one entity and totally not require that on another entity, and there's nothing in here that gives guidance as to when or when that would be appropriate.
Mr. Chair and Senator
Ms.
Howe,
Conte.
Thank you for the question. So this language mirrors what exists already within Chapter 317A. So the Attorney General's office right now is capable of entirely waiving notice, waiving waiting periods around nonprofit entities and their disposal of assets. And that is not tied to a particular standard or trigger or set of trigger criteria. The reason for that is a couple-fold. One is just the nature of the Attorney General's enforcement abilities. There is that discretion piece that is usually built in. The second piece is that it allows the Attorney General to waive in the instance of an exigency, something that's failing and needs to move rapidly, et cetera. Also, if we look to past as precedent, we know that in the nonprofit space, the Attorney General does waive these notice requirements with some frequency for things that are like very minor transactions that have met the letter of the law to require notice, but don't in fact implicate substantial state interests.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Senator Howe.
Thank you. And I can understand that if we gave guidance in here, if it was a minor thing or in a certain section, but this looks like even including the requirement for disclosure or submission to the commissioner. I mean, is this identical in those situations too? I'm not comfortable with giving all that authority to one person to make the decision that who's going to get that information and when they're not going to get that information. I guess if he doesn't want it, that's one thing. But disclosure to a commissioner, I think, is a whole entirely different thing.
Ms. Conte.
Mr. Chair and Senator Howe, so it's not entirely an apples-to-apples comparison because in the nonprofit space there isn't that...
I'm sorry, could you pull the microphone closer?
Apologies. As I said, not an apples-to-apples comparison entirely because in the 317A landscape there isn't a second agency an agency implicated in the notice requirements. But it is a similarly pretty open ability for the Attorney General to waive the notice. In terms of why is it just the Attorney General and not, you know, the Attorney General and the Commissioner jointly deciding to waive notice, it's because the Attorney General is the one within this arrangement who's entrusted with the enforcement aspects of it. And so it is kind of in keeping with that that cabining of discretion to the Attorney General of whether they're going to be bringing an action, whether something is going to merit further enforcement action.
Ms. Conte, could I interpret that as saying that the Attorney General's office would have a number of tools at their disposal, including the disclosure requirements, but they would have the option of choosing not to use some of those tools and waive those requirements?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. And again, so in the nonprofit space, sometimes we'll receive an initial notice or some sort of kind of preliminary information, and we'll communicate a written waiver of the remaining notice period if something appears to be sort of below a reasonable threshold, even if it meets the letter of the law.
All right. Senator Howe, any follow-up on that point?
Well, and I understand all of that, and I guess I, as long as it's, I think where I have the problem is in this case, the agency is involved, and I don't know, I guess I'm not comfortable, I guess I'm not totally, I'm just not totally convinced that the commissioner of the agency shouldn't have the information in the disclosure. I guess that's where my concern is. I don't have a problem with the AG having the authority to waive that disclosure to him, but in this case, the agency's involved, and why are we taking the agency out of the mix? That's my concern.
Senator Limmer, did you, now that we have folks back in the room. Did you want to re-ask your data question? I promised I'd come back to you. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could ask counsel on page 10, line 15, I believe, there's a reference to the term confidential data. Is that in reference to an ongoing investigation, or is it on medical records that would the data definition would be more appropriate to be called private or non-public?
Ms. Primo.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, this would be data that the healthcare entity provides to the Attorney General and the Commissioner under this entire section. So in some ways, I suppose it is somewhat investigative in that the Attorney General's collecting information to make determinations about the public interest standard. We generally don't put protected non-public or confidential, or try not to use those classifications absent situations like an investigation and ongoing, civil adjudications. So it's a policy choice for the committee and to decide on that.
Senator Limmer.
Question, counsel. Usually the operative definition for the use of confidential means that the subject of that information cannot get information on the use of their own information in an investigative context. Is that the purpose of the reading of this portion of this bill?
Ms. Primo.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, yes, I believe so. I believe because it's and it might be a question, I suppose, for the Attorney General too, what their goal and intent is here, but typically in an investigative setting, the goal is for the subject of that investigation to not have access to that data while that investigation is ongoing. This is somewhat different, somewhat similar. There's certainly a policy choice there for the committee to make about what's appropriate and whether this information should or should not be available to the subject of that data.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer.
I had another question that I'd like to get an answer on outside of this area.
Would you like the Attorney General to weigh in on that last question at this time?
Why don't we have their office?
Ms. Conti, could you give us a position of the Attorney General and an explanation for why that provision is there?
Certainly, Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer. Yes, so that information is, we've asked for it to be confidential in line with our other investigations in that pre-litigation posture. The Data Practices Act allows us to keep things confidential until a matter is resolved, until an investigation is closed.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer.
I'm satisfied with that explanation. I would like to bring our attention to page 7. I'm just reading quickly through the bill, and I see on line 7.13 there's a reference to something called Hart-Scott-Rodino filing. Could the Attorney General's office tell me what that is and why is it in the bill?
Ms. Conti.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, Hart-Scott-Rodino Act, a federal antitrust law, there are notices that are required to be filed with the FTC for major transactions. The threshold for those is high. It's, I believe, over $100 million. But to the extent that some of these transactions trigger that federal requirement, we are asking to receive a copy of what is submitted with that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer.
I don't know how broad that reference is, the Hart-Scott-Rodino filing. Is there a U.S. code number that might be a little more specific that we could make reference to?
Ms. Conti.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, I apologize at this juncture. I would need to phone my antitrust friend as well to have the exact code cite. My understanding is that Hart-Scott-Rodino notification is a term of art, that it is kind of a discrete filing that people who do this work understand. But I can try to get more detailed information for you swiftly.
The only reason I bring it up,
Senator Limmer,
Mr. Chair, is that I don't know how broad this is. Is it 20 pages of federal law, or is it a specific paragraph? I don't know. And how broad, what broad authority are we giving to the Attorney General in this case? So that's the only reason I'm raising that question of, is it possible to have more specifics on that reference?
Senator Limmer, it sounds like it's a within that specific field. It's a pretty discreet and well-known filing, but it might not hurt if we can just cross-reference the U.S. code that's related to it or CFR that's related to it. That might be more specific. We'll get that information. Senator Howe.
Thank you. Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And going down that line, why don't we just follow the federal Hart-Scott-Rodino Antitrust Improvement Act and just follow that piece instead of looking like we're rewriting the whole thing?
Because we do it better here in Minnesota.
I understand that it's that way with codes and everything. We're smarter than everybody else in the country.
We're special, Senator Howe. I'm sure you'll agree with that. Ms. Conte, did you have a response to?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Howe, thank you. Echoing the chair's comments, yes, we do things better in Minnesota. Hart-Scott-Rodino is not a healthcare-specific type of notification. It's federal antitrust notification. So we are drilling down here in this bill to deal with the particular challenges of healthcare consolidation. And so part of the impetus here is that federal antitrust law, state antitrust law, through a series of court interpretations has really narrowed. It is not getting the job done with respect to looking at these transactions. That is why 29 states have already made these sorts of steps to gather additional information from healthcare entities and to scrutinize these healthcare transactions. Hart-Scott-Rodino, because of its high threshold, because of its relatively limited pass, is not getting us the full scope of information. If it was, we would have happily just given our federal citation, which is 15 U.S.C. 189. Thank you to my phone a friend. And that last is either 18 or 189, or it may be 18A. My phone a friend has penmanship like my own. It's an A.
It's an A. So 15 U.S. Code 18A?
Yes. Yes.
Section 18A.
It is narrower. We need more specificity, and we, you know, especially in some of the spaces in greater Minnesota, that high federal threshold may not be giving us visibility into small rural hospital closures and things that are of concern to the members of this committee and the rest of the state Senate.
Senator Limmer, would you like us to incorporate the 15 U.S. Code Section 18A reference into the line 7.13?
Mr. Chair, I'll trust the limitations of that and move to include it in the bill.
Senator Limmer moves to allow council to make the necessary language as they follow up with the bill to incorporate the federal statutory reference. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Actually, well, yeah, we can do it that way. All right. Senator Cruen wanted to ask a question. Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to go back to page 10, lines 13 through 21. Senator Limmer might have been satisfied with the answer. I can't say that I am satisfied at this point.
Dissension within the GOP ranks.
Right.
Senator Cruen. Ooh, I think that was the Democrats that were the subject of that line, I believe. And by the way, just so folks know, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Senator Cruen, because there are a number of changes that are proposed by the Attorney General's office that Ms. Primo has not had an opportunity to thoroughly vet at this point, let alone incorporate into an amendment, and because those are squarely within the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee. When we're done with this line of questioning, because we have another bill we have to get done here, we're going to lay this back on the table. I'm sorry, Senator Wicklund, I know this needs to move, and we accommodated leadership's desire to have this hearing quickly this morning, but a few pieces apparently need to fall back into place. I commit that we will reconvene this committee as soon as that's ready to happen so that we can keep the bill moving. All right. So Senator Kroon, why don't you go ahead, and then after that, we're going to lay the bill on the table, and we'll, if there are any follow-up discussion, we'll have another opportunity at another hearing to do that. Senator Kroon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, and I understand this section here could relate to pre-litigation. It could concern data, but the term that's used is information, and specifically on lines 10.14 and 15, any information exchanged. Information is a pretty broad term, and I think is broader than data. And I guess, you know, what is information is one question, but really why, in my view, why would the information at that stage that's being exchanged between the Attorney General and the Commissioner need to be confidential beyond traditional attorney-client privilege concepts and beyond statutory data practices classifications?
Ms. Conte.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kroon, so I think this language here is provided so that we can be sure that those communications about kind of this discrete area where we are essentially relying on the Department of Health to be our experts, right, that this is sort of a work product trying to carve this out and have it be treated in that way, because it is a pre-litigation posture, because it is information we are relying on their technical expertise to help us enforce the law at this investigatory and potentially pre-litigation stage.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kroon.
Thank you. Well, I'll just add the word work product to it. I mean, these are all concepts that everybody in the law understands. Attorney-client privilege, work product. These are already confidential. So why do we need to paint a broader picture in statute that simply that says any information exchanged at all, which I would interpret to be beyond attorney-client privilege, beyond work product? Why does that need to be confidential and out of the public's view? This, yes, there is pre-litigation going on here, but there's also public policy decisions that are being made here. The Attorney General is consulting with the Commissioner to determine whether the transaction is contrary to the public interest. There could be things, information exchanged between the two parties that is not attorney-client privilege, it is not work product, that does not meet statutory data practices classifications that absolutely should be made public, and the public should have a right to that information. I think this is way too broad in the interest of transparency as to what's going on here. And you can comment on that if you want, but I do have one more line of questioning, which will be on page 11.
Mr. Chair and
Ms. Conte.
Thank you, and Senator Kuhn. I think the concern is that as a default position, the Department of Health does all of its business out in the open sunlight, and 99.9% of the time we think that's absolutely appropriate. To the extent, though, that in this limited sphere, they're being asked to be our hired experts, to be in that pre-litigation space, again, it is a lineup to the AG possibly taking something to the court, where then again, things will be back out in the public eye. It's just any litigator knows you want to keep things in close hold until that case is brought forward.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kroon, brief follow-up, please.
Thank you. And I would just say that the Attorney General's office should do that all the time. They should know how to protect attorney-client privilege, work product doctrine. They don't need this broad of a statute to conduct this pre-litigation exchange of information. They should be able to do that already under existing precepts. I don't understand why we would need such a broad statutory protection here to make confidential things that don't fall under those things. But that's just my comment. I really want to get onto my final line of inquiry, which is on page 11, 1114 to 1118.
Senator Kroon, I don't want to cut you off unnecessarily, but I'll tell you what the plan is. I'm going to ask if you can hold it. The plan right now is we will lay this bill on the table. We're going to recess to the call of the chair, hoping that maybe we can return this early evening. Ms. Primo is also counsel to the Conference Committee on Judiciary Public Safety, which is meeting in 45 minutes. And is uncertain how long that will take. But
reserve.
We will be returning
Got
to
it.
This bill either today or probably the latest tomorrow morning, which will give Ms. Primo enough time to do her council-related work. Can you hold your follow-up until then?
Yes, I will hold my follow-up till when we reconvene.
Thank you. Yep. So let's do that. House File 402 is laid on the table. Just watch the notices online for when we reconvene on this topic. So thank you, Senator Wicklund and Ms.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's that time of session. I totally understand, and I appreciate your giving it time this morning, and I'll be awaiting time to reconvene. So thank you.
Absolutely, Senator. Thank you. So our next agenda item is Senate File 2319. So we'll invite Senator Fateh to come to the testimony table. While we've got a break here, I've noted that there have been a number of instances in the last half hour. Mr. Cooper, if you could hold on a moment, please, just inviting the Senator Chief Author to the table. Thank you. We have had some interruptions from electronic devices in the last half hour or so. So I'm going to ask members of the public that are in the room here, please check your electronic devices, phones, and so on, and make sure they are inaudible so that we can focus our attention on the proceedings on the bill without interruption in that regard. Thank you very much. We now have before us Senate File 2319. Now, Senator Fateh, welcome back to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, sir.
This bill was heard by this committee in the past. It was laid on the table at the time, awaiting further work on the bill. I have been asked to put it back on the agenda and convene a hearing again for further consideration of this file. So, Senator Fateh, could you please give us an update on the status of the bill and what you're seeking from the committee today?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you so much for taking up the Senate file this morning. I'll try to be brief. I know a lot of the members have heard a lot about this bill already, so I'll try not to drag out my opening remarks. We went through all of the committee stops from labor to commerce. It went through all the stops on the House side and is headed to the House floor. And this is the final stop. Within each committee, we've done a lot of updates from the wages side, from the side of the insurance. And there's been a lot of changes to this bill from the time it was formed till now. And this was done with all the stakeholder agreements. We met with TNC companies, we met with leadership, we met with drivers. Right now we're down to just a few components of the bill. The most important ones being the wages, the insurance piece, as well as the deactivation clause. Right now, drivers can be deactivated for any reason and not told why. We've had members testify saying that they've gotten robbed, they've gotten beaten. A member came with a bloody shirt that he has on today as well. And when these things happened to them and they went to the hospital, when they came out, they not only had a medical bill that they couldn't afford and that they had no help on, but they got deactivated. And for these folks, a lot of them, they purchased their cars. This is their sole source of income. So this is devastating for them. So we want to make sure that if there is a reason for your deactivation, at least the TNC has to bring a reason why that's happening. For the wages...
Senator Fateh, if I may, you mentioned that you consulted in the course of the process with the TNCs.
Yes.
Is there an agreement with the TNCs with regard to the deactivation changes or language?
I do not believe so, Mr. Cooper. I do not believe so, no.
Okay.
But... again, when there's a compromise, both sides are not going to be happy with the result. Right now, the drivers, for example, were upset about the wages being dropped dramatically.
Okay. I just wanted to focus, because you mentioned several different categories, so I'm trying to ascertain the status of the stakeholder involvement as it comes to us here today.
Absolutely.
Okay, so the deactivation clause is still an open question in terms of stakeholder coming together on it.
Correct.
Okay, you were going to address the wages provision.
Yeah, so originally, the original bill had $2.55 for the per mile. The per minute, I believe the original bill had 64 cents or 69, I believe. And they had also reimbursement for gas, for wear and tear. There was also a 19-cent fee that would go for a board for an appeal process. So all of those reimbursements or rates are gone. And in fact, we reduced the amount that we originally had for the per minute. So right now, I believe Uber reimburses or provides wages of 21 cents, I believe, per minute, whereas Lyft does 28 or 27 cents. So we just met halfway. The bill has 25 cents. And that's down significantly from what it was originally. And also, we went down to $1.85 on the per mile, the rate per mile. And that's also down significantly. I believe 10 years ago, it was at $1.96. So we're still not at the rate that we were at 10 years ago. So those are some of the changes that have occurred between the wages and the deactivation clause.
Right. And could you tell me, is there stakeholder agreement with regard to that point at this time?
On both sides, no. Yeah, no. But the drivers are willing to accept $1.85. They're not happy about it, but what we did was we wanted to ascertain
the status on that.
Correct. And I'll give you the reasoning also. There was a lot of talk about this being the most expensive in the nation, and that's simply not true. Under this bill, we're still cheaper than Seattle, in fact. I believe Seattle has $1.50. And with 59 cents, I believe, per minute and $1.50 per mile. But under this model, we're still cheaper. So we would not be the most expensive. That's simply not true.
Okay. And then you'd mentioned insurance as a third category, as I recall.
Yes, correct.
That's the other area that's still open in this discussion?
So that one actually became the closest. We had an agreement in Commerce. We were guided, so this bill was also laid over in Commerce, where we were guided to speak with the insurance group, Mr. Aaron Cocking, to get language that was suitable. We did that. We brought it to Commerce. Uber suggested that we went from a 50-50 model where the driver pays 50 and the TNC pays 50 to 100%. So we agreed on the framework that was provided by Uber and worked with leadership, both the House and Senate leadership, as well as the insurance company or the insurance group to make the language that it is today. And probably Mr. Cooper could speak better to that, of how that was formed.
So are you saying that there is a stakeholder agreement with regard to the insurance provision at this point?
The framework, yes. The language, no.
Okay. One of the reasons I'm pressing on this is because one reason we laid it on the table last time was because there was no stakeholder consensus on how to proceed, and there was no consensus within this committee on whether and how to proceed. And part of the point of laying it on the table was to give an opportunity for all the stakeholders to continue to work on the bill. And it sounds like it, at this point, it still has not yet achieved agreement. Now, sometimes it doesn't, you know, agreement isn't possible. I understand that, but I just want to at least figure out what our status was.
I understand. And with that, the stakeholders, if I may be recognized, Mr. Chair.
Senator Fata.
Thank you. And with that, there are some situations in which stakeholders will not agree. We've had bills, for example, where oil companies were upset, pharmaceutical companies were upset, hospitals are upset. In this situation, the TNC has indicated that no matter what, they will not be happy with this bill. The bill also, in the form it is right now, the drivers are not happy with the way it is, but they're willing to accept it because it's a step forward. So the alternative to this is doing nothing. And doing nothing means that the drivers continue on the path that they're on. And a lot of these folks, this is their sole source of income. We've seen their rates drop dramatically over the last 10 years from about $1.96 per mile, like I said, to 61 cents per mile. And to me, that's not fair. So that's why when this came to a standstill, we worked with leadership. We worked with both House and Senate leadership and council on the language. We spoke with the drivers. We also reached out to the TNCs again. But leadership was happy with this. The drivers are willing to accept this. And I believe that this is still a good step forward. The goal also is to come back maybe and rework on other things that were cut out from this bill. But the bill as it is right now, I think, is a major step forward.
Okay, I didn't understand your last line there. The goal was to come back, you saying next year and work on other things, or still within this session?
There's other disagreements, so there are several parts of this bill that was taken out. The drivers are willing to not have that be discussed. So that can be a discussion next time or not at all. Right now, the most important thing is these provisions that are in this bill right now. These are the most pressing areas of need right now that were indicated by the stakeholders.
Okay. Could you, Senator Fateh, could you clarify for me what you mean by next time?
So there were several parts of the bill that was taken out. For example,
Are you talking about, I'm sorry, are you talking about this session? When you say next time, are you
What I'm saying, the next time the parts that were removed can be discussed, which is why they're removed.
What does next time mean?
In the future
a new
sessions.
Hearing on Friday?
No.
Sometime before May 22nd?
In future
or
sessions.
Or spring of 2024?
It could be spring of 2046 in future sessions.
Okay, but not this session.
Not this session, correct.
Because I don't want to proceed with a bill that we may consider passing today just to know that you're going to plan to reopen and everything in the next week and a half.
Whatever is agreed upon, whatever is passed on this will go to the floor and pass as is on the floor. There will not be any future amendments from there.
Okay. Thank you for helping me understand the process here. And, of course, all we can do is consider it in this committee. What happens on the floor is a whole separate analysis. I appreciate your confidence on that. Okay.
And I hope to be not held to the spring 2046 comment either.
This meeting is recorded, Senator Fateh. Senator, here, we'll turn to Senator Pappas in a second. We have about 30 minutes to go. And if we aren't able to wrap up in those 30 minutes when we reconvene for the other bill, either today or tomorrow morning, we'll follow up on this. But my goal is, if we can, to reach a decision on this here today. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to thank you, Senator Fateh, for all the work that you've done in this bill. It's kind of barely adequate in terms of what should be done for drivers. It's a difficult life. I don't know how you all do it. You could make a lot more money being truck drivers. I just want to say that. There's a shortage of truck drivers. But thank you for trying, and it seems to me you've compromised a great deal. And like you said, it is a step forward, although, you know, clearly no one's happy. But that's what happens around here a lot. It's half a loaf. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Fateh, I understand there's an amendment coming, and you had a testifier that was going to speak in favor of the bill. So you're the chief author. How would you prefer to proceed here at this time? Do you want to consider the amendment, or do you want to go to your testimony?
We can. If the amendment's ready, I'm not sure if it's ready or not. There was an amendment and then an amendment to the amendment as well. There was an amendment to the amendment.
So there's an A14 amendment, which makes a number of changes to the bill, which I understand it's a delete everything amendment. And then there is a proposed A15 amendment coming to address the civil action as it relates to the A14 amendment. So we're going to proceed to the A14 amendment.
Absolutely.
And then when the A15 is ready, if it is in time here, we'll consider adding that to the A14.
Correct.
So, Senator Fateh, would you like to address the amendment right now or have Mr. Cooper testify? This is why this is a good idea testimony, but specific to what we are going to be focusing on here today.
Yes, he can do that. And then I'd also like Mr. Cooper to remain, if possible, for technical questions, if that's okay.
I'm sorry, would you say?
I would also like Mr. Cooper, after testifying, to remain for technical questions, if that's all right with the chair.
As long as Mr. Cooper is willing to remain in the room, then he'll be available to answer questions. That's fine, but we also have one person we've identified ahead of time to testify in opposition to the bill. I'd like to proceed with considering the A14 amendment, and then after we have the presentation of the amendment, I think before we go into discussion of it, we'll ask Mr. Carlson, who's the other identified testifier, to testify, and then we can proceed as a committee to analyze the amendment. Mr. Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the...
Would you please go ahead and just state your full name and your affiliation for the record?
My name is Stephen Cooper, and I've assisted MALDA at creating this legislation.
Okay, what is MALDA?
It is the Minnesota Uber and Lyft Drivers Association, and they are the ones that have been championing this bill. There's about 700 of them here in Minnesota.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. What you wanted me to focus on is the civil action, and this is very different than when you and I talked about it a long time ago.
Okay.
A lot of things have been taken out.
I'm sorry, Mr. Cooper. We don't have a civil action in the amendment A14 in front
of us. That's the amendment that's coming. It was inadvertently, when they were cutting and pasting, left out, but that's the one that we were waiting to come, and that should be here shortly.
We are still waiting for that to arrive. So before we take testimony on that, we're going to have the amendment in front of us, okay? Was there anything else that you want to testify to in connection with the A14 amendment? Do you want to walk us through the A14?
I'll be happy to.
All right.
The A14, as Senator Fata indicated, is a compromise taking out many, many things that the TNCs were upset about and others were upset about. Let's first go to the minimum compensation. The minimum compensation in the bill, as was just described, is less than it is, for instance, in Seattle, because there's two things that make up the pay for a driver. One is the per mile and one is the per minute. And the comparisons that have been made have only looked at one of those two, not both of them. When you take the two together, you look at a city like Seattle and probably many others, we actually are lower. And don't forget, what the drivers are making right now is less than half of what they made in 2014. And out of their money, out of what they make, they pay for everything. They pay for the gas, they pay for the car, they pay for the repairs, they pay for the maintenance. So whatever they're getting, it's kind of like a business. You know, there's only so much that's actually profit. The rest of it is cost. And in this particular case, the costs have gone up dramatically in the last few years. And as those costs have gone up, the compensation to the drivers has gone down dramatically. So what we have is you start off with they get less total money, and then they have dramatic increase in expenses. And I think everybody remembers what happened to gasoline prices over the last couple of years. It certainly was all absorbed by the drivers, not the TNCs. What's interesting is Uber, a few months back, was bragging in the newspaper that they had record revenues. So during the time period that Uber is getting record revenues, the driver's having record low compensation. It's not hard to figure out where those record revenues are coming from.
Okay, Mr. Cooper, I'm going to ask you to please focus your comments on the details in the proposed A14 amendment, which is a delete everything amendment. Can you tell us specifically, please, what it does? We don't have time for a broad policy promotion about the bill. We've heard this bill before.
I appreciate that. What it does is set a minimum of $1.85 and 25 cents, $1.85 per mile, 25 cents per minute to the drivers. It also indicates that if there's a cancellation, that the driver, if they've gone to start to pick up the person, will get a cancellation fee. It sets $1.25 and 10 cents per minute for when you're driving empty. And what I mean by that is that you get a call and it says, you're in downtown Minneapolis, says, pick up somebody in Shoreview. Right now, the drivers get nothing for that ride, but Uber does. And Lyft, though, they charge for that. And often, if you ride an Uber and Lyft, you'll see you have this huge charge for a ride that if there had been a car nearby, wouldn't be there. The drivers get none of that, so it gives them a portion of that in this bill. It also says that the TNC software, if it's used, which it almost always is, to collect fees, but they don't collect it, they still have to pay the driver for what they owe them. It also says that all tips for the driver have to go to the driver. They cannot be taken by the organization. Let's go to the next part, which is deactivation. Deactivation has been dramatically reduced. It essentially says that, and I'm going to make it very simple, as you asked, it essentially says the TNC has to tell the driver why they're being deactivated. Deactivated is a euphemism for fired. They have to tell them why they're being deactivated, and they also have to give them the opportunity to be heard. Now, that hearing is done by the TNC. But what we have now, and just during this session, there's probably a dozen different drivers who have come up to me and talked about the fact they've been deactivated, don't know why. So this is to address that. If you're going to deactivate somebody, you have to give them the right to be heard. They have the right to appeal that internally, and by that I mean they have the right to appeal it somewhere up in the TNC organization. The TNC has to have written rules as to what will get you deactivated, and they have to comply with those. I'm going to a very fast version. Of course, I will answer any questions you might have. Going to the next section.
Let me just ask you one question on that.
Sure.
Is that prospective only, or does that include a retroactivity?
It's got a retroactive portion, and the retroactive, I think, if I remember correctly, Mr. Chair, goes back to 2019, and that's because we have a lot of drivers who appear to have been deactivated because they were either had a visible disability, or they were female, or they were had some other biased reason. In many of those situations, the passenger was drunk or the passenger was unruly, and we want them to reconsider those. Before, you didn't get told why you were fired, unless you were lucky. Okay, the next is revocation of license. That's purely a local thing. It just says a local entity may revoke a license if this law is violated.
License to do what?
To be a TNC. Every city requires a TNC.
To be a TNC or a driver?
No, TNC, to be a TNC. The drivers don't need to be licensed, to the best of my knowledge. I may be mistaken on that, but that has not come up. It's the TNC that needs to be licensed. So,
okay, so you're saying that the TNC's license could be revoked. We're on line 4.16, by the way, I believe. So the local unit of government would have the right to take license action based on failure to comply with this bill. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. Originally, it had the Department of Labor and Industry doing that. There was complaints that it caused cost to the state. There was complaints that that was not something they wanted to do, so we took it out.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead and please proceed.
Transparency is merely saying, as you may anticipate, the TNCs have tremendous data collection because they need it to keep track of who owes them what from a customer standpoint. And it's merely saying that the data that they already have about a particular driver, that is to say how much they're being paid, at what rate, how far did they drive, et cetera, has to be also shared with the driver. And that's all that's doing. Then as we go to, we make very clear, I'm sorry, I'm skipping one. It also makes clear that a copy of the bill has to be given to the drivers so they understand the change. It also requires that this bill does not affect in any way whether a driver is or is not a independent contractor or an employee. It does that in two places, in Section 7 and Section 9. And it makes very clear that this bill does not enter into the conversation that comes up almost every year in the Senate and in the House regarding independent contractor status, employee status. It says, notwithstanding any other provision of the law, this does not weigh in on that. So what that allows is that discussion, whatever it is, takes place in a different forum, and any decisions that are made about that takes place in a different forum, not in this bill. This bill is, I'd almost call it a rescue bill. It's trying to rescue the fact that these drivers are making an unlivable wage with huge expenses. I think I got everything, but I may have missed something. I'm not sure. I didn't hit the two sections that are in the next amendment that's coming to you shortly, one of which is the reason we're in this committee, which is the legal the right to go to court, and the other is the anti-retaliation section.
Okay, Mr. Cooper, counsel was requested to prepare a civil action provision, but not an anti-retaliation provision, so that is not available for us to consider at this
Fair
moment,
enough.
And it's not going to happen in the next 15 minutes either.
That's fine.
So
that's fine.
We'll decide when we get close to 10 o'clock what we have left to be able to do, and if we can conclude this morning or if we need to return when the committee comes back after a recess. So thank you for walking us through on those. Let's take the time right now to invite the opposition testifier to the table. Mr. Cooper, if you could please have a seat back away from the testifier table, and we'll invite Mr. Carlson to come forward. Joel Carlson is the one I was told was testifying. Is there another Carlson that's planning to testify? We'll flip a coin. Yes, go ahead, Mr. Carlson, too. Joel Carlson, if you please identify yourself and your affiliation and go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of Uber Technologies, a company I've represented since they first operated in Minnesota in 2012. We have profound problems with the bill that's before you to suggest that this is a compromise in any way, maybe with among themselves that they've changed it, but it certainly doesn't reflect anything that represents a compromise for us. This has public safety problems. It has cost problems that I want to go through with you in the A14 amendment. And Mr. Chairman, I want you to know that we want to strike a compromise, and we have reached a compromise with at least one group of drivers. I have great respect for what your committee does. I think I appear in front of this committee and have spent more time here than anybody in this room. I have great respect for the drivers and the work they do. I'm not going to ask you to vote no. I'm not going to ask you to amend this because I understand the dynamic that you're faced with. But you need to know the implications of this bill. To the A14 amendment, Mr. Chairman and members. The first problem is on page one, on line 1.28. This requires a TNC to provide insurance to a driver anytime they are logged on to their app. That is not in place anywhere in the country, anytime they are logged on. And it requires the TNC to provide all of the insurance that is required under Chapter 65B. That is not in place anywhere in the country.
Mr. Chairman.
And what is that insurance, Mr. Chairman? This is not...
Correct. It is important because all of that is related to commerce, which we already went through. I asked to stick with the judiciary piece, Mr. Chair. Yes. Correct. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. At the top of page two, it requires a first report of incident within 10 days after an accident, which is clearly a long period of time for something to happen before the company even knows that there has been an incident. It requires $1 million of medical insurance and $500,000 of disability. This is not an insurance product. It's not for sale in Minnesota. We have offered an insurance product that we can obtain that is for sale in Minnesota, but that has been rejected. We have to name the driver as an insured. Mr. Chairman, these insurance requirements are not in place anywhere in the country, and the cost for the companies to provide this will be so prohibitive, and the insurance attaches anytime your phone is on. No one can do that. It's just unworkable, and we have repeatedly said that. As it relates to the minimum compensation, one of the things that is problematic for riders, and they're kind of ignored in this conversation, the per trip compensation is very challenging for TNCs. This requires a per trip calculation of every single trip, and it does not allow for a biweekly or other type of compensation so that you can balance out. The TNCs, Uber, and I believe Lyft as well, subsidize these trips to get them to happen. And when you pay on every single trip, there's an incentive to just take short trips, and that's all you do. So we have long argued that this pay standard needs to be on a biweekly basis. It just doesn't work. The compensation is up for debate. It is, I can tell you, from our perspective, the highest in the country. There is not, on page 2.25, there isn't a single jurisdiction in the country that requires a TNC to pay mileage to go and pick up a passenger. That is not in place anywhere in the country. We have serious problems, Mr. Chair and members, with the deactivation process that is in this bill. This will force us to bring sexual assault victims in to testify at a hearing that we have to conduct, and it precludes a deactivation of a driver prior to a hearing. So we can have information of an assault from a passenger, and we cannot, on line 3.16. We cannot deactivate them until after there is a hearing and an appeal. That again,
Mr. Carlson, can you tell me the exact language where it says they have to
3.16, Mr. Chairman, it requires that we have to have a hearing with witnesses regarding the alleged infraction prior to deactivation or a sanction being imposed. And that is in more than one place in the bill. That, I think, is problematic for victims and for the companies. And as when you do take up an amendment relative to a civil action, which if it's the same as it's been in the bill before, that subjects us to attorney's fees, costs, and treble damages. This is a serious, serious problem. Mr. Chairman, this has a four-year look back during a period of time when we do not even have records for. And it says on line 4.4 that they must be reinstated on situations where we don't even have the records.
Where is the four-year look back provision?
The look back provision, Mr. Chair members, is at the top of page 4.1 through 4.5.
Thank you.
Goes back to January 1 of 2019. And it says on line 4.4 that a driver must be reinstated, and you're talking about situations where we probably don't even have records anymore, which is, means we have to reinstate
or witnesses available 4 years ago.
Come again?
Might have difficulty finding witnesses.
Mm-hmm. The witnesses
in the last 4 years who were riders.
And we don't retain the records either, and we didn't know we needed to retain those records on a deactivation. We don't... These companies need the drivers. We want the drivers. We don't deactivate drivers because they're female. That's ridiculous. That doesn't happen. If there's a deactivation, it's for a serious issue. We need more drivers. We don't want to deactivate drivers. This also says that our local license can be revoked. We're not licensed by the state. We're licensed by every local jurisdiction. And the Minneapolis Ordinance 343 has a list of disqualifying offenses that we may not be able to disqualify them for under the bill, and yet we could lose our local license because we're not complying with their ordinance. This is just poorly written and not thought out as to how it works in practicality. And as to transparency, Mr. Chairman and members, much of the information is already provided to the drivers. If you look at this, they know what it is before they take the trip. They get the trip log. It's all in their driver account. They know how much they're paid. They get every single tip. All of that has already taken place, and to suggest that it isn't taking place is a problem. What is problematic about the transparency is when you get to page 5, 5.7 through 5.10 requires us to disclose all of our business calculations of how we arrive at a fare. And as you know, these people are independent contractors, and we support that very much. But you're saying that we have to disclose that to our competitors. Almost all these drivers are on both apps, Uber and Lyft. And we have to, under this language, provide to them how we calculate the information. So, Mr. Chairman, we have significant problems with this bill. We have been trying to reach an agreement. This is not it. I understand the situation you're in. This committee has fixed bills, and they have defeated bills and passed good bills. I don't know that that's available here, but if you want to fix this bill, we stand ready to work with you to try and address these very glaring problems that do not exist in any TNC model in the country. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Carlson, number two, if you could give us your full name and affiliation. Members, it is now 10 minutes to 10. We have Judiciary Conference Committee publicly noticed to start at 10 a.m. So we're going to take a few minutes for testimony here, and then we're going to lay this bill back on the table, and we are going to take it back up when this committee reconvenes either this evening or tomorrow morning to address both this bill and Senator Wicklund's bill that we had as the first item on the agenda. So, Mr. Carlson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Andrew Carlson, here on today on behalf of Lyft. I'll be extremely brief. Everything Mr. Carlson just says Lyft would agree with. This bill is, to put it gently, is not ready for prime time. But again, we are committed to working with all stakeholders to resolve this. We would like to see a bill get passed still this session, but this is not the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. While we are there any questions for either of these two testifiers? Now, actually, I take that back, because we're just going to lay the information out for us right now. We're going to hold questions unless there's something urgent, because just because we don't have time to go too deep into these issues at the moment. While we have the Carlsons at the testifier table, any particular questions for either of them at the moment? Not including Senator Carlson. We are in Minnesota, after all. Senator Westland.
Can I get some clarification about what parts of this are actually within our jurisdiction, Mr. Chair?
Well, we're being asked to adopt a delete everything amendment, some of which may be in our jurisdiction, some of which may not. There's a lot of due process issues in here. For one thing, I'm not entirely clear, because it's not government due process. But ordinarily, we wouldn't be in a position of addressing an entire bill that's before us, but there have been changes throughout the bill since the last stop. So it's a little bit ambiguous. I'm torn, as you are, Senator Westland. As you know, I prefer to keep our jurisdiction focused on the topic, immediately focus our attention on the matters within our jurisdiction and the bills before us. That's getting a little bit difficult to do this time of session with this bill, and I think with the previous bill as well.
I just didn't want to venture into territory, and it seems like that horse is out of the barn in any event, based on some of the testimony received. So I was just curious.
Unfortunately, the alternate route would be to send it back to the committees that did have jurisdiction over the changes that are being proposed in the bill before us, and that's not a practical option either. So we might be the last committee to kind of go through this. Senator Westland.
I understand the time frame too, Mr. Chair. I do have questions for our testifiers and regarding what's before us, and so hopefully we will have the opportunity to do that later.
I will make sure that when we reconvene, we have ample opportunity for committee members to ask questions and evaluate the bill that's before us, and for the proponents and opponents to provide their input as we go through the process. This is important. I want to make sure we have ample opportunity for the committee to hear it, and we can make an informed decision. Was there something, Senator Cruen, real quick?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and this may be a moot point given your response to the jurisdiction question, but I was going to chime in. I think we're waiting on an amendment to the amendment regarding a civil action. Do I have that right?
And that is correct, Senator Cruen.
So I was just going to pipe in. It's almost impossible to determine, for me, not having seen the amendment to the amendment or knowing what's in it, to determine what's in our jurisdiction, because the civil action component, could how that relates to this delete everything amendment, to me the whole thing could be within our jurisdiction depending on how that's worded. I was just going to chime in, but it sounds like that's kind of a moot point.
Well, the civil action language, I think, will certainly get before us when we reconvene, so we can evaluate it in the whole context. And if there is an anti-retaliation provision that was mentioned earlier by Mr. Cooper, there'll be opportunity to prepare something in writing in connection with that as well. And we'll just have to, at this point in session, I think we're just going to have to take up what comes to us and do the best that we can under the circumstances. Senator Limmer, did you have something to say before
just
we lay this bill on the table?
Just a very brief question, more of a general question. This seems like this bill is putting the legislature in a position to solve a labor dispute. And I don't know if that's really our proper role or not. I don't know if this industry is a regulated industry recognized in the state, but if it's just between two parties, an employer and contractors, or whether they're employees, why is it here? Why can't they solve their issues through their own negotiations? So I'd like to have a little background when we come back, Mr. Chair, of those that want this, and try and answer that question so I know what our proper role is. Thank you.
So, Senator Limmer, I appreciate the question. As you know, anyone who introduces a bill, whether they think it's a proper role of government or whether we think it's a proper role of government or not, the bill comes through the process and we consider it. That's up to each member to decide whether they think it's appropriate to pass a bill of that nature. But if you'd like to flesh that out a little bit more, we can later. Ultimately, it might simply be a question of whether you inform you on how you will vote on the bill. But I want to make sure we give ample opportunity for both sides to present their arguments and their testimony and for this committee to consider it as well. And we're at that time of session where it's tough to juggle everything. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. When we talk about labor laws, though, we do significantly intervene in the market. We have minimum wage laws. We have laws that say children can't work. We have safety laws in place. We are currently debating whether we should require earned sick and safe time and family medical leave. So we significantly tell businesses that they need to provide a minimum of protection for their employees.
All right, we'll leave this final comment then with Senator Pappas for this morning. We will reconvene, and I apologize to all of the drivers who came here. I know that you are, this is time away from earning your living, I hope that you can return when we reconvene as well. But obviously, this is an issue that has been of some discussion over the course of the session, and I think we have a duty at least to try to make sure we give it full consideration in the process here. Senator Limmer.
Could we get a copy of the A15 amendment to peruse until we come back tonight?
Senator Limmer, it is hot off the presses. Ms. Primo was just informing me that she has it present. It is now coded the A17 amendment, and we will distribute it to committee members now so that you can take a look at it, if you wish, between now and when we reconvene.
Thank you.
So if you stick around to wait for your copy of the A-17 amendment, we are laying Senate file 2319 back on the table, and the committee is in recess to the call of the chair.